from the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Notstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence, at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end of what's really happening in your old North State.
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. I'm here with my good friend Brooke. We're going to be talking about babies. I have one coming on the way. Talk a little bit about movies, conservative movies, and the midterm elections. Kathy Manning in the Ted Budd race has been moved from lean Republican to a toss-up. And we might just talk about a few books, too. So, Brooke, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. And I like the alliteration, the babies, books.
Yeah.
Bud, Ted Budd, district.
There was a lot of alliteration there.
Yeah, it's wonderful. So, so you have a little one on the way. Can you tell, when's he due?
He is due October 29th. My wife was telling me that he was due the 17th because I think she wanted him to be due the 17th. She's about done with this pregnancy and she wants baby Henry to come out. So we're just waiting and it's exciting. I just went to an ultrasound Thursday. I think it's like might be the final ultrasound, at least for me. And it looked like he had a little bit of hair like James. To me, he looks like James, our firstborn son, who's only like 19, 20 months now.
Wow. So two little ones in diapers.
Yep, two little boys. It's going to be exciting. I don't know what advice you have for, because you have some kids that are close in age, right?
Yes. So my first three were pretty close, like about 2.5 years apart from each other. And then our fourth was 5 years from
the
next.
I like Abe a lot. He's a cute kid.
Yeah. That's my 5-year-old and he's adorable and a lot of fun. He likes to say things for shock factor though. So he learns bathroom humor and stuff, all the stuff that little boys like to talk about, right? That's kind of gross and grosses girls out. That's Abe. He likes to talk about
my
that.
Son's he can be a little gross sometimes. it's kind of weird because I'm not a big bathroom humor guy, and sometimes I'll just look at him with like my,
so where'd he get that from, huh?
I don't know. It's a good question,
but that's exciting. And I'm sure your wife is really ready to just,
she is definitely
have the
ready,
baby in her arms.
I think she tried to talk the doctor into inducing and he was like, no.
It's a little too early to talk that, right? That's funny. That's exciting. But that means that you'll probably be out at least for one of our recordings for our show. So we're either
maybe one. Yeah, because I would expect possibly one.
Yeah, but we'll definitely be looking for a baby update.
Just don't replace me. I mean,
oh, no, we can't. You are irreplaceable, Ray. So we can't replace you, but we can try to provide the audience with someone else that has your intellectual acumen for that week at least. So
sounds good. And also, I was just scrolling through, I can't remember if it was Twitter or something on social media, and I saw that they were thinking, it hasn't been confirmed, and I know there's been rumors around this for a while, but they're thinking of making a Rambo movie. Did you ever watch Rambo growing up?
So I did watch Rambo growing up, but I probably haven't seen it since I was growing up. It's been a really long time, but I do have those memories of, was it the very first one when he was walking down the road hitchhiking? He had just come back from war.
Yeah, he was a Vietnam veteran. I know that. I don't think I watched much Rambo. I remember the one, I think he went to the Middle East or Afghanistan. That's the one that I do remember from my childhood.
What year were those? Here, I'm going to look that up. What year were those made?
Started
Rambo.
In the early 80s.
I'm
going to
look it up while we're talking.
80s.
Let's see. Yeah, they were, well, of course, starring Sylvester Stallone, that 80s stud. There was one in 2008, I guess, that came out. But The First Blood came out in 1982.
Right.
And so my husband has the whole collection, though.
Oh,
he's a Rambo fan. He has that and Rocky.
See, I was more into Rocky.
Mm-hmm.
And
Adrian!
I lived in Philadelphia for about a year, so I've been up those steps. And,
Got stuck in that area in Delaware, actually, which was really close to Philadelphia, over Christmas time because of we were on military flights. We were trying to catch a military flight back to the West Coast where we lived. And the weather was so poor that we got stuck over there. So we spent a few days in Philadelphia and did just a quick trip. And I made sure my husband and I both agreed that we needed to go see the Rocky Steps. So we did that and then had a Philly cheesesteak.
Yep. The city of brotherly love, which I always thought was somewhat oxymoronic because there's a lot of mean people in Philly. It's not as bad as Boston, though. I like Boston as a town. It's a cool place to go and there's cool things. But it's a little bit different if you're from, spend a lot of your time in the South.
Yeah, there's a different aura that people give off over there, and it's kind of like this do not bother me aura. But yeah, back to the movies though. So they're coming out with a new Rambo one.
Well, it's not official. I think Stallone is just trying to hype it. But it made me think about conservative movies today, you know, because Rambo was sort of pitched as a conservative movie in the 80s, and a lot of stuff Stallone has done has been pitched as a conservative movie. Of course, Rocky, I think it's Rocky IV where he fights the Russians. I can't remember if it's 4 or 5, but I mean, as a kid, I love that film when Rocky goes to fight Drago after Apollo Creed's killed. But it just got me thinking a little bit about conservative movies and this whole idea of a moral imagination. And I think, Brooke, you know, you're the director of communications here at Civitas, so it gets to an important aspect of how do we tell this conservative story. I think that's important today because, you know, you just can't talk about policy or you just can't talk about facts, but how do you convince people through culture, which the left has been so successful in terms of just doing over the last, you know, really a century.
Well, even you raise a really good point, and it's something that I was talking to our president and our policy analyst, so Donald, our president, policy analyst Leah Byers, about yesterday with regard to the importance of story. Mm-hmm. And even with this voter ID debate going on, the left seems to have names of people that they can say were disenfranchised, or they will try to spin a story around a name or spin a narrative around a name, and that resonates with people. There's something to be said about that.
Absolutely. Because it's important. It convinces people, right?
It does. Because it appeals to our emotional side. Right. We are not just factual creatures that run on reason alone. We run on emotions, right, too. That's not necessarily bad either. I think that that helps us navigate some of these messier parts of being a human. And so we do need to tell those stories. And so that's a great thing. A great reason to have films that maybe have more of a conservative, individualistic, overcoming, you know, spin to them. This sort of commitment to country and greater causes, causes greater than oneself. Those are really important as well. And we don't see a lot of that in Hollywood anymore. We see a lot of political tail spinning going on with what's coming out lately. But there have been some great conservative films out there. And I know you and I were running down one of the lists that National Review actually has on their website.
I think it's 50 conservative films.
Yeah. So they've got all these conservative films. The ones I'm looking at, the list I'm looking at is actually from 2009. I think there's a newer one, but this is called The Best Conservative Movies. I've seen a few of these. I think you've seen more than I, but number two on there is The Incredibles, which I thought
seen
was
the
great.
Incredibles.
You haven't?
No.
See, James isn't old enough. See, my older kids were really little when The Incredibles came out, so I definitely saw it. But that talks about the power of just family and the importance of sticking together as a family, which I think is beautiful, especially in this day where people are so inclined to be driven by personal success and wealth and things like that, and other people knowing who they are. But really what matters is how do I live at home? Where's my integrity really at? And so The Incredibles does a good job. But give me some of your thoughts on conservative movies. What's a good one?
Sure. I'm going to talk just about a couple films, and then I'll go into Sunset Boulevard, which some of our older listeners will know. It's a film from the 1950s starring William Holden, who I think my mom had a big crush on. He was an actor.
How do you know your mom had a big crush on him?
I think she told me
before. You heard her swooning over him.
Yeah. But anyways, he had a rough life, but We Were Soldiers. Have you seen that? I know you're...
I have seen that. My husband makes me watch all the military movies.
I would think he would
love
that.
And they all run together.
It was, had this time where there was all these movies like Platoon, just anti-Vietnam, anti-American movies came out, and Mel Gibson starred in this film, and it was We Were Soldiers. It was about a... Gosh, I can't remember the general's name. He was a general later in life. I don't know if he was a general at the time. He may have been a lieutenant colonel. But he wrote a book called We Were Soldiers Once and Young, and it was made into a film. I read the book. It was great.
Lieutenant General Harold G. Moore.
Yes, Hal Moore was a great Army commander, and it was just about some of the sacrifice the men made early in the Ia Drang Valley in Vietnam in 1965. So I just thought that movie was very powerful in terms of just depicting sacrifice and depicting the importance of America in its anti-communist godless crusade that it was against. Not that everything obviously that happened in Vietnam was a benefit to us for sure, but it just sort of depicted different pictures against many of the anti-Hollywood films like Born on the 4th of July or Platoon that came out. But I also liked one of my favorites, and I don't know if it's classified as a conservative film, but I see it as a conservative film. Have you ever seen Master and Commander with Russell Crowe?
Yes, I have, but I saw that when I was maybe 18.
Yeah.
I don't remember much about it.
I thought it was a great film. It depicted this whole idea of, you know, Britannia ruling the seas against the French. I think it was happening maybe a little after the French Revolution or during, and it was just kind of a cool film, I think, that depicted the warrior culture. And another one, I would say, we talked about right briefly before we started recording, was Cinderella Man.
Yeah.
It's about the boxer Jimmy Braddock, and of course, he gives his welfare money back after he makes it big fighting a match. And I just really thought that was a great film. It was directed by Ron Howard. Just the way it was... did storytelling, and it had a very the struggles during the Great Depression and what was going on. People were losing their houses, people were being thrown out in the streets, and Braddock, of course, worked down on the docks. He was a boxer, injured his hand, and then he made a comeback, and he was even better than he was before. And it's just an interesting story about family life, not just the boxing match that was just this huge thing during the Depression. He was a hero to a lot of Irish Americans too, but just a lot of Americans in general. And I just thought it was powerful in the way that the family stuck together through such horrific times. And he was able to just pull himself up by his bootstraps. I thought that was a really powerful. Of course, there's that scene in the film, which is true. It's not just Hollywood, where he paid back his relief money during the Depression after he got some money from fighting again. So I think one of the best conservative films, though, and it may be from a Christian's perspective in some ways, is Sunset Boulevard. There's been a lot of films, Brooke, that have been made against Hollywood, inside Hollywood. Sunset Boulevard is one of the ones that kicks it off. Of course, L.A. Confidential, I think in the 90s, plays off some of those themes. But Sunset Boulevard starred Gloria Swanson, who was a actress from the silent area. She came back to make this film, and it was about the narcissism in Hollywood and just narcissism in life in general and the emptiness of it all.
And that was even before selfies were a thing.
Yeah, yeah. So it was just this... film that depicted the extreme narcissism in Hollywood with some of a regular America, and it has some really interesting contrasts, and it was kind of a film noir, and it was just, to me, it's kind of haunting, but it shows the emptiness too of just society in general, where you just want to be famous or you want to be well known. And I always thought that was a great film. So
yeah,
I would love to hear from some of our listeners. I hope they would reach out to us what they think is a great conservative film is. I mean, there's so many that we're not mentioning, obviously, but I think just the point of talking about this really is to stress the moral imagination. Russell Kirk, who's a conservative scholar, talked about the importance and stressed about the importance of storytelling. T.S. Eliot, of course, too. There's a lot of figures in history that urge conservatives and people with either a spiritual or Christian worldview and not a materialist worldview to get out and tell those stories, because you're right. I mean, conservatives haven't done that very well, and we have an opportunity, I think, to do that through art, through film, through music.
Part of the reason we haven't done that, though, is because for a while the left would issue false facts. I first and foremost think of the pro-life issue and When Life Begins, and they would issue these unscientific statements claiming to have some sort of insight into scientific facts, and essentially, though, they were rewriting how we understood science. And so conservatives became really focused on responding or reacting to that with actual facts. And so that was almost the way we began fighting the idea war, was through data and information, which there is a lot to be said about that. But so it's excellent when you can fight the transgender debate with biology and chromosomes and things like that, and understanding physiology and things like that. But there also has to be an understanding that there are real people going through this emotional turmoil, and certain policies affect them in a very personal way, and they affect their families, and we should get better at telling those stories of those people. So there are short films on YouTube, for example. PragerU actually does a good job inserting little stories from time to time. I remember Dennis Prager did one on the death penalty, and he made the moral case for the death penalty by sharing the story of a family who was brutally murdered. So he was sharing a story. It was albeit a very difficult one to stomach, but that was how he made a moral appeal. It wasn't through the facts of, let's say, recidivism. Not in the death penalty case, but he wasn't trying to point to, okay, this doesn't deter future criminals and things like that. It had more of a moral stance, a compelling moral reason to actually implement the death penalty. And so I think that that's just powerful, whether it's something like the death penalty or you're advocating for a policy such as ending corporate welfare and showing how that is adversely impacting taxpayers that are in the middle class bracket. So definitely much to be said about telling stories, which is also why on our last episode, I solicited stories from people and just their thoughts on things. And you and I continue to do that. We want to hear from our listeners because there's power in understanding how a policy, which, you know, gets played out in legislators' heads and they think, okay, this just makes good sense. But how is it playing out in your own life? Yeah. Those are the things we want to hear about. So
yeah, it reminds me a little bit of the gospel. I mean, it's not a list of facts, right? I mean, it's all depicted through story. And I think that's just so powerful in our culture, in our world today. It's just story just has an immediate impact upon our hearts and really reflects the sort of vision that we want in our own lives is to just triumph through story.
Yeah, absolutely. Which, you know, there are many stories that we will be sharing over the months, maybe even personal stories that just have to do with our own experiences, such as Ray getting ready to welcome his child into the world. And as we move into the holidays, maybe we'll reflect on some family traditions and things like that. But
what is your least favorite holiday?
Ooh, my least favorite. Because Groundhog Day, because it only bodes well every once in a while for me. And I get so tired of the cold in the wintertime.
Yeah.
That is kind of a disappointment.
But I like groundhogs, so I don't know if I can say it. They're kind of cool animals.
Yeah, Patoxy.
I love the importance and significance of Thanksgiving, especially from a biblical perspective and everything about it and some of the stories about Thanksgiving, but it's probably my least favorite holiday.
Really? That's sad. Why?
I don't know.
I don't understand that.
Like yams and all that stuff. And
then don't eat them.
You know, there's just some of the food. I'm not into green bean casserole. Like, who eats green bean casserole?
Me? See, oh, my goodness.
Brooke and I are so different. Yeah. I find this out every day, how different I am from Brooke.
How much cooler Brooke is than Ray.
No, that's not what I said.
That's what he meant.
I just didn't want to say that I was better, and so I was trying to be polite. We're different.
But green bean casserole,
like, most casseroles I don't like for some reason.
Wow. Well, where are you from again? Well, you're a military
kid. I've lived all over.
But see, so my mom is from the Midwest, and so she raised us on casseroles, like tater tot casserole, taco casserole, scalloped potatoes. I mean, that's just, we ate casseroles all the time.
Yeah.
It was amazing. So I have a little difficulty accepting your dislike for casseroles, but whatever.
You know what we should talk about? The election.
Yes, we
Let's
should.
Talk
it's
about
coming up,
this
isn't
upcoming
it?
Election in November. First Tuesday in November.
So I know we've made some predictions in the past, primarily you did. And I know you had mentioned that you think at the federal level, at least, that there's a good chance that the Republicans lose the House.
Oh, yeah. Nancy Pelosi is coming, y'all. So get ready for that.
Be
the glassy
prepared.
Eye, the, you know.
Oh, okay. We'll see. But you also said that you think there's maybe even a chance the Republicans will gain a seat or two in the Senate.
Do you think that's still the case? I think Florida's crucial.
Okay.
Because Democrats are probably going to pick up Arizona, and they're probably going to pick up Nevada.
What about Texas?
I don't think Beto's going to win in Texas.
No.
I think this is a liberal utopian dream. They want Beto to win. But Beto's been on the defensive a little bit with this drunk driving, you know, fleeing the scene. And so he's a little bit on the defensive right now.
And his journalism, because he was supposedly, like, characterizing a woman or women in a play
This is what I think of Beto. He's a very astute politician, you know. I imagine to some women, he's very attractive looking. He's kind of handsome or whatever. But I think he has a ceiling still in Texas at 45 or 46%. So I don't think he's going to overachieve at those numbers. And I think Ted Cruz will win. I think it may be like 3, 4, 5, 6 points to win by. So, but Texas is a state because so many people from California are moving to Texas and other states. And North Carolina deals with this somewhat, right? I mean, you got people from the Northeast. I always struggle with that, people who are leaving high tax regions and then come down and vote for more high
and
taxes.
And want more high taxes. Yeah. It's insane. We don't understand
it. We could have a whole show just on that. But yes, please stop doing that. If you're coming from somewhere else, don't vote for more high taxes.
Yeah, because clearly there was a reason you left that other place, and so don't make this place that way, okay? Yeah,
please.
Can we all agree?
Yeah. I like North Carolina. I don't want to have to leave.
Yeah, I already bought a house here, so let's not do this. But, you know.
But anyways, Nevada and Arizona look like the Democrats are going to have pickups there, although Arizona's still a little bit of a toss-up, but probably a likely Democrat. And then it looks like Republicans are going to pick up the seat maybe in Missouri, but definitely North Dakota. Heidi Heitkamp, who came out against Kavanaugh, I think is going to lose pretty dramatically in North Dakota. So you have two pickups for Republicans. Tennessee is a seat held by Republicans. That's a toss-up. Florida's a seat held up by Democrats. That's a toss-up. I think those two races are key at the Senate level. And Republicans can pick up a seat if they can pick up both of those. They pick up at least one seat. And I think they can pick up Florida. I think Rick Scott's a good candidate. Bill Nelson's the incumbent in Florida, the Democrat. He's been there a long time. But I think Rick Scott's well-liked, and he's doing a good job campaigning there. So it'll be interesting to see. That's another toss-up state. And here in North Carolina, it is Kathy Manning versus Ted Budd in the 13th district here for the congressional race. That has been moved from lean Republican by the Cook Political Report to a toss-up. And also, I think Larry Sabato, who's a political analyst, moved that, his crystal ball, also to a toss-up.
Mm. Well, and not only was it lean Republican last, but before that, it was likely Republican.
I think you're right.
So it's going down this ladder, which, you know, calls into question whether or not, you know, there really is a blue wave that some should be anticipating. But on the other hand, Republican motivation is going, starting to go up in light of the Kavanaugh hearing. So,
bless you.
Sorry, I had to sneeze. So we'll see, but it is, we're going to actually be polling the Ted Budd district again. So it'll be interesting to compare it to
absolutely. He was
July
up five
when we checked last
time. He was up five, I think, in
which
late
was
June.
Outside of the margin of error, but only slightly, I think. So,
and one of Ted Budd's biggest complaints, you can offer your thoughts on this, Brooke, is that she's raising most of her money from out of state. I think it's like a little over 55% of her money comes from out of state. And NNO did a fact check on that, and they said, yes, Ted Budd's right. She is raising most of her money from out of state. I think 27 or 28% of Ted Budd's funds are from out of state. So that's quite a disparity.
It is. That's almost double what his outside funds are. And that just, I think that goes to show you, though, how organized and mobilized and motivated Democrats are at the federal level.
Right.
I'm not so sure it's the same as at the local. I think to some degree, yes. But there's a lot of influence coming from the outside. And that also, you know, makes one wonder how committed is that candidate? If they're receiving over half their funds from people that aren't in North Carolina, who are they really representing when they're actually in office then? Where do their loyalties lie? And I'm not saying that just about Manning. I'm just saying I think that's a valid question to consider, is when you have donors, which campaigns can't be run without them. I mean, it costs a lot of money. It's just the nature of the beast. But you do want to consider, okay, where is this money coming from? Why is it going into her particularly from out of state? So, you know, I just don't know. I don't know enough about Kathy Manning and that the outside funders, but I just think it's a valid question, is following money. But
she's spending a lot of money on ads. I know there's one ad about healthcare and pre-existing conditions. So Kathy Manning is hitting hard on the healthcare thing. It must show some polling positives for her on that issue. So I suspect.
Yeah, North Carolinians care greatly about healthcare, immigration, and the economy. Those are three of the top issues, I think, at the federal level. So, it'll be interesting to see how that shapes up the political climate of North Carolina and at the federal level.
Did you get your ballot? The voter guide. We should talk about that for just a minute or two.
Yeah, I did. It was funny. My dad was looking at his voter guide this morning, and he gets a little worked up about politics.
Yeah.
And so when I was dropping off one of my children to their house, he pulled it out and I was watching him write in his voter guide, and he would circle faces and he would write fake on there if he didn't think it was somebody that
That's
was
pretty
legit.
Funny.
And then other one like X, don't vote for.
What did he do with Chris Englund? Because I read that and I was like, wow, this guy's pretty much hinting that he's not really a Republican.
It was fascinating, wasn't it? He said that, you know, he's running as a conservative to represent the constitutional conservatives. And then the Republican conservative and Republican positions on the constitutional amendments were opposite of what he's running for. So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, he was very critical of the amendments that were put forward by the Republican Party in North Carolina. And so I just kind of skimmed Barbara Jackson's, but the Chris Englund thing, he's going to end up a spoiler in that race. There's no doubt about it.
Well, if you've been following this at all, you know that he did change his party affiliation shortly before he submitted his application to run, or his intention. So it's an interesting race, and our polling actually has Anita Earls definitely as the front runner in the Supreme Court race right now. So we'll see. And Anita Earls, if you don't know who she is, she was the founder of the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. She's actually, which the Southern Coalition for Social Justice is in our Mapping the Left website. And you can just kind of trace some of the donors that have given to that organization. And they focus on voting and, trying to think of some of the other big, they do a lot with regard to lawsuits and cases.
We're going
to
have a lot of polls coming up, and we're going to talk more about elections on this podcast. So stay tuned with us and hang with us, because we're going to have some good stuff in the next couple of weeks, just polling numbers and also just some analysis on what's going to happen in November. Let's close out, Brooke, today talking about books. What are you reading right now?
So I am actually, I use air quotes reading, but I'm listening to an audiobook, and I'm listening to 1984 by George Orwell.
That was a great year.
What, the year itself? Or
yeah, I was in kindergarten. That was a great year for me. Yeah.
Kindergarten's so much fun. How could it not be a good year?
Right. I had Mrs. Booth. I still remember her. She was really, really nice. And
oh, you remember your kindergarten teacher's name? Yeah. That's good. I don't know. I want to say mine was Mrs. Johnson, but that's just because that's a generic, easy name to choose.
Mrs. Booth, and she was, I don't know if she's still with us. She wasn't terribly old, but she was.
But you're kind of old, so
that's
that means
true. That's what I mean. I'm just playing. Trying not to go there. But I'll be 40 next April, or this coming April.
Ah, wow. Okay.
That's pretty depressing.
Six more months in your 30s.
I'll probably write something on the Civitas blog, Reflections at 40.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah. Something different.
So. Well, yeah, so where were we at?
We're talking about books. You're talking about 1984.
Okay, yeah. So I'm on like chapter 6 of that. And I love just how we take a lot of the way conservatives coin and phrase a lot of things nowadays is actually pulled from George Orwell, which I knew that before, but I had never actually read 1984. So I've been enjoying that a lot. But something that he, you know, talks about is doublespeak and newspeak. Yep. And annihilating the language, you know, to reduce words to just very, very simple, basic definitions. So in the hope of that, the purpose of reducing words in this book, 1984, to that by these nefarious actors, their reasoning was that then people couldn't describe the bad things that were happening under the communist regime because there would be no words left to describe it. And you just see how there's this brainwashing going on. What is it? The Ministry of Love.
Yeah, there's all these different ministries.
There's these different
ministries.
The right. Ministry of Truth, the Ministry of Love, Ministry of Peace, which was the war ministry. And so, and even George Orwell, in one of the chapters, he's talking about how they're changing the meanings of words and how instead of the opposite of good being bad, the philologists, so those language people that were writing this newspeak language for the people, said, no, instead of that, you would just say non-bad or unbad or ungood. So get rid of the word bad and just take that word good and say ungood for bad. And so by replacing these things slowly and chipping away at the nuance and beauty of language, people would be inept to actually describe real feelings. And I think that's really something that we do see going on nowadays. We have butchered words where the word justice, for example, so many things fall under that. When you think of the word justice nowadays, it's something that comes to my mind right away is social justice. Yeah. And that's really not... That's so politically packaged and charged that justice is now becoming this word that maybe even some on the right are hesitant to use right. because of the connotations. And it shouldn't be that way. Justice is a very good thing. And I think we need to redeem that word.
I think that's a very good point. When I was in seminary, I had a hard time because we'd have these social justice conferences. And because the word was so politically loaded, mm-hmm. and sometimes the conferences were good, sometimes I thought they were too political. But, you know, I would immediately kind of tune them out or not listen because of the loadedness of the word there.
Yeah.
And so I'm reading a book called, if I can remember the name of the book, but it was Last Men Out. I don't remember the author. It's a really good, interesting book about the fall of Saigon in 1975 and the Marines. And it was basically an Alamo situation. A lot of people have seen the documentaries. I think maybe Rory Kennedy, one of Robert Kennedy's daughters, did a documentary recently called The Last Days in Vietnam. But this one's called Last Men Out. And it's just kind of an interesting story about some of the heroics of the Marines in the last final hours at the embassy and what was happening there. It was just a chaotic situation. And it's kind of a depressing end to a long saga in Vietnam. But I thought it was just a powerful book about you know, fighting to the last man and, you know, trying to do what was right. So
sounds like a great book.
It's a really good book. And I encourage people just to learn about military history. It's been something I've enjoyed reading. So just in general as a category, and I've learned a lot of different things that way. So we're out of time, but I want to say thank you so much for being with us, and we'll talk to you again soon. Thank you, Brooke.
Thanks, Ray. Have a good week, everyone.